Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I think that a lot of the reason why Christianity has fallen away, particularly among the educated people, is that people can't swallow this literalism. You know, it's obvious that a book that begins with a talking snake is not history.
The Medicine Path podcast is an ongoing exploration into the intersections of spirituality, depth psychology, and psychedelics. The Medicine Path is a wholly independent and listener-supported project, so please consider becoming a supporter at patreon.com/medicinepath or by subscribing and leaving a review on iTunes. You can find out more information at medicinepathpodcast.com. Now, here's your host, Brian James.
Welcome to the Medicine Path Podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. This is part two of my conversation with David Tacy. In part one, we spoke at length about his time in analysis with famed post-Jungian writer James Hillman, and we talked about David's critique and praise of Hillman's psychology. In this second half, we get into a discussion around Jung and religion, David's book Religion as Metaphor, and the limitations of both Jungian psychology and religious literalism. In the end, our conversation digresses into some good old-fashioned gossip, and David lets rip on misogyny in depth psychology and why Jordan Peterson pisses him off so much. Now please, sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation with David Tacy on The Medicine Path.
Now, one of the things that stands out to me is that books based on Hillman's work sell well, and books based on religion don't sell well. Now, let me give you two examples. Tom Moore and myself. When Tom Moore went back to explore religion, he lost a huge amount of his following. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many books did Care of the Soul sell? It was over a million, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think 1.6 million or something extraordinary. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for months.
And he was on Oprah as well.
Yeah. Now, when Tom went back to religion, his readership fell right away. And I think he had all sorts of troubles about his publishing career. The soul's religion didn't sell very well.
Oh, do you mean religion of one's own?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Religion of one's own. Yeah, that's right. And in fact, this isn't personal, so I can say it publicly. He wrote me a letter and he said he was really disappointed that his new stuff's not selling as well as his old stuff. And I said, tell me about it, Tom, because when I came back to Australia from working with Hillman, I decided to write a Hillman-style book about Australian culture, which I called Edge of the Sacred. And it was a bestseller. It just astonished me. It got on bestseller lists. I mean, I was on television. You know, it was like America had come to Australia. I couldn't believe my luck. Well, then I wrote the men's book. And, of course, men in Australia were very enthused by Robert Bly, not by me. And they didn't like it. So my men's book sank like a stone. And then after the men's book, which was 1997, I returned to religion. And my readership fell right off. You know, I started to reclaim Christianity, to try and reread Christianity. In fact, one of my latest books is called Religion as Metaphor. I wanted to call it Religion as Myth, but the American publisher said, you're not going to call it that because that'll be read as a rubbishing of religion by Americans because of the negative relation we have to the word myth. So it was really a book which should have been called Religion as Myth, but because of this fight with the American publisher, I had to call it Religion as Metaphor, which doesn't have as much bite to it. I don't think it sold very well. So I said to Tom, I'm in the same boat. When I write in Hillman's style, my works sell tens of thousands, which is big in Australia. You know, Australia's population is less than the population of California. Mm-hmm. We're a tiny country population-wise, but we're as big as USA in terms of the landmass. So the popular readership is in a Hillman mood. It's not in a reclaiming Christianity mood at all. And so that's a big problem that both Tom and I have faced, I think, that the popular following that we once had falls away. I mean, I can't remember the last time I was invited on television. I mean, it's so long ago, more than 20 years, I think, because I'm now regarded as too religious.
Yeah. I have a feeling that things are changing. I think, you know, because of people like Jordan Peterson, you know, think what you will about the way that he frames Christianity and the way he dissects it and all that. You know, I have my own issues with that. But he has been part of this resurgence of interest in Christianity in North America and I think Europe, which is interesting to me. But what I'm seeing, like kind of ground level, taking notice of this, is that it's a return to religious literalism, which is what you're speaking about. The problem with that in the book Religion as Metaphor.
Yeah, the whole book is an attack on literalism.
Yeah,
and it was the front cover has a quote from I can't even find the bloody thing. The front cover has a quote from a Canadian, John Dooley, from Carleton University. Is it Ottawa, I think?
Oh, yeah. Isn't he like a Jungian pastor or something like that?
Yeah, he's a Catholic. He's passed on now. Poor John. He's a Catholic priest. Like me, a very strong critic of Catholicism. And he wrote a comment for the cover of my book. It said something about this book is trying to save religion from itself, from its own literalism, something like that. I think that a lot of the reason why Christianity has fallen away, particularly among the educated people in North America, Europe, of course, especially Britain, and here in Australia and also New Zealand, is that people can't swallow this literalism. You know, it's obvious that a book begins with a talking snake is not history. You know, the snake says to Eve, take this apple, you won't die. In fact, your eyes will be open. You know, I mean, my God, you know, isn't it obvious? Like, duh. You know, of course it's about bloody myth and metaphor and symbol. And therefore, the whole thing is ripe for a Jungian reading. So in my book, Religion and Metaphor, I try and attack the literalism religion of religion. But the book hasn't sold well. I mean, it's met with a very mixed, downbeat response. Mm. And I think the reason is two reasons. One, intelligentsia like me, a university professor, they're not interested in Christianity anymore, and they don't want to even read a book which tries to revision Christianity in a non-literal vein because they've lost all interest in it. And the Christians who might want to read books about Christianity don't want to read that the whole thing has to be de-literalized and read as myth rather than history. So I feel like my book falls between those two stools. The intelligentsia that are just over Christianity and the popular Christian audience who don't want it see it critiqued.
Well, you know, I'm in the demographic that finds the book really helpful. And so I'm a layperson, I suppose, grew up in a secular family, but, you know, Christian heritage. And so it's kind of in my DNA, this Christianity. And once you start thinking about a spiritual life, I think for me, you have to reckon with Christianity at some point if you're going to be like honest and authentic about it. And so what's the way in? You know, I go to a church and I don't see a whole lot happening there that interests me. But the images that come up are so evocative to me. Kind of inexplicably, you know, why do I have this emotional relationship when I see Christ in the Sacred Heart? I don't know, but I want to investigate the power of that image. Yes, and the only way to do it that I've found is through Jung. Like Jung for me is the bridge between what I think of as my mythic mind and my modern mind. You know, the mythic mind is the mind that where I experience mystical experiences and the psychedelics and yogic experiences and all of that. But I can't live just in that mythic mind, you know, because I know about psychology, and we've had Joseph Campbell come along and show the similarity of all the world religions. So there's no going back to that. And the only way forward for me was a bridge of those two minds or two worlds views, and Jung was the guy for me.
That's so good. I like that very much, the modern mind and the mythic mind. You and I are quite similar. I've always wrestled between these two minds, you know, but the mind that was, I don't even call myself professor anymore because it puts me in the modern mind. I don't want to be in the modern mind. My anima, or the anima, as Hillman would prefer to say, wants me to be in the mythic mind. And that's the poetic mind. That's my creative side, my musical side.
I think you should just be an elder, you know?
Yeah, but I think my parish priest read my book on religion, and he really enjoyed it, and I found that astonishing. But we had the coffee over it, and he said, David, I thought Jesus was special. Because in the book, I argue that Jesus is a symbol of the self, and that just as Jesus is important for Christian, Buddha is important for Buddhists, and Muhammad is crucially important for Islam, and so on. And I don't think that I've never felt that Jesus is the exclusive one and only Son of God. You know, that's it's a great myth. It's a great story, but it's not an historical fact as the Christian people pretend. And my priest clearly felt quite challenged by that, because Catholic priest, you know, he'd spent his whole life telling other people that Jesus is special, the one and only Son of God. You know, that's what it says in the Apostles' Creed, which all Catholics recite every Sunday. I never believed it. So when we were supposed to read the Apostles' Creed, I would stay silent as a protest. But look, I didn't want that to crush my religious life. I loved the Eucharist, which, unlike Protestants, we celebrate the Eucharist in the Mass every week. And I know the Protestants don't do that, apparently. But I thought, well, I'm not going to allow intellectual problems to stuff up my religious life. So there's enough of my mythic mind that is still pleased by Christian ritual, sacrament, you know, and the Mass. As Jung famously said, and he said this to an audience in London in an essay called The Symbolic Life, he said, part of me wants to be a Catholic, but part of me would love to be a Catholic. But I can't. It's not what I'm here to do. And I read that as him saying that his mythic mind was attracted to Catholicism. Sure was. Look at all the essays on the Catholic Church, the transubstantiation of the Mass, the essays on the Trinity, the essays on all dogmas to do with Christianity, mainly Catholic. And, of course, Father Victor White, who was a Dominican friar from Oxford in the UK, took a strong interest in Jung. For many years, I think it was 25 years, they saw each other, talked about the relationship between psychology and religion. Jung found this exciting because, as you know, Jung's background was Protestant, and so it was very important for Jung to get Catholics interested in his work. But then when Jung wrote Answer to Job, I think, what was it, 1951 or something like that, that terminated his relationship with Father White. I don't know if you've seen in Canada, but I've seen it several times in Switzerland, a dramatic a presentation called The White Jung Letters. Have you seen it?
No.
Oh, it's fantastic. I've seen it two or three times, each time in Zurich. It's a dramatization of this relationship between Jung and Victor White. And it was, to me, it was like psychodrama, you know, the two sides of my brain having an argument with each other. And, of course, tragically, really, both of them, they separated. They couldn't reconcile their differences. Father Victor White went off, basically betrayed Jung. But Jung was already in a mood which was like, go, you know, like Jung was sort of like...
He's done Jung, with them.
Yeah, Jung daimon was very strong, you know. He wasn't willing to conform to Christian dogmas and doctrines. And Answer to Job was the book that terminated his relationship with Christians. And that's why, if I can make another comment which could be perceived as anti-American, the American Jungians domesticate Jung far too much, thinking of that whole group that write books on Jung. John Sanford, Morton Kelsey, Wallace Clift,
Murray Stein.
No, not I wouldn't include Murray Stein in that category. No, Murray Stein's different. Murray Stein, his book called Jung's Treatment of Christianity is quite a special book, and Murray Stein has the courage to come out and say, "Look, Jung's following a different faith." But the other people I mentioned, especially John Sanford and Morton Kelsey and some of the other people, kind of papered over Jung's quarrel with Christianity. Even this new book, which I like, called Religion, Religious But Not Religious, by a fellow in Boston. What's his name?
Jason Smith, yeah.
Yes, Jason Smith. I read that book with great interest. But I think essentially he's wrong. And if you want sparks to fly, get Jason Smith on your iPod, your iPodcast, and let's have a debate about it, because I think he's far too soft. Jung was a strong critic of Christianity. He didn't say we want Christian ritual at any price. In fact, in his essay, The Archetypes of the Collective Unconscious, Jung says, if we can't find ourselves at home in Christianity, let's just accept our hollowness and our lack of heritage. The fact that the cup is broken, Jung says. The cup is broken. He was referring to the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jung has terrific courage. He loved Christianity. Of course, like all of us, he had a great father complex as well. He kind of despised his father, actually, and particularly after his formal induction into the church, where he says in his memoirs, nothing happened.
He was so disappointed even as a boy.
Yeah, even as a 12, 13-year-old, his God was shitting on the church in Basel. You know, I mean, that's... And the Freudians had a field day with that, of course.
Anal aggression.
Who continue to hate Jung, write about that with great relish, that Jung's God shat on his father's church. They refer to it as anal aggressivity.
Mm-hmm.
And the Freudians love it. But the Jungians have a very different reading of that daytime vision of Jung's. They see it as that there's a new revelation at hand. Edward Edinger, for instance, is a very sensitive reader of Jung and Christianity, unlike the other ones I mentioned. And John Dooley in Canada, very sensitive reader of Jung and Christianity. So I read all this stuff, obviously. Sometimes I read it over and over again to try and figure out who's right and who's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think Murray Stein is right. I think John Dooley is right. And I feel personally that Edward Edinger is right, that Jung, in fact, is announcing a new kind of religion.
Yeah.
Not that Jung himself is the religion. I think that's complete nonsense. But I think Jung is a prophet of a new kind of religion, which is going to be heavily based on Christianity, but also strongly drawing from Buddhism as well, which Jung referred to as the world's two greatest religions.
Right, because of the emphasis on direct experience?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
See, Christianity... This is why it's failing, in my view. It doesn't emphasize direct experience of God. In fact, as Jung correctly put it, Christianity erects walls against direct experience, you know, walls of dogma, walls of doctrine, so that people don't get, ignited by the living God. Because Jung felt that the contact with the living God is a very dangerous thing, and that many people aren't able to survive that contact because they would just burst into flames. Annie Dillard says that in her book, what was it called? Like Teaching a Stone to Talk and all these types of things. She says that people sitting in church should wear safety helmets in case the Holy Spirit really descends on them and breaks their skull open. I could really relate to Annie Dillard on Christianity. Jung thought that, as you know, Jung was very ambivalent about Christianity. On the one hand, it tried to give people an experience of God, but on the other hand, it actually tried to not give people an experience of God. So his view of Christianity is very paradoxical and indeed quite contradictory. And I think toward the end of his life, Jung didn't come back into the Christian fold at all. He was far too fascinated by alchemy. He got seduced by alchemy. And all of his last works, like Mysterium, Cognitionis, Psychology and Alchemy, that long essay on the transference, you know, they've left Christianity behind and have taken on board Gnosticism, and taken them very seriously. Christians today still regard Gnosticism very negatively, partly because of its emphasis on immediate experience, which, of course, that kind of immediate experience undercuts the authority of the churches. So Catholics don't like Jung's emphasis on direct experience. But some Christian churches do, like the Quakers, for instance, you know, which you could argue is the original Christian mysticism in an institution. And some of those churches actually love Jung. I'm amazed that I haven't become a Quaker.
I've thought about going to the House of Friends more than once. Yeah. The only time I've been in one was to go to a Sufi dance.
But I think Christians, Jungian Christians in America have a lot to answer for. They're selling Jung short. Jung isn't ultimately a Christian. He wrestled with Christian in the way that Jacob wrestled with the angel of God by the river. Jung wrestled with Christianity, but did he embrace it? No, I don't think so.
But no. On the other hand, something that I hear said is that psychology was meant to be a replacement for the religions that were no longer functioning for the culture. And I don't think I don't think Jung thought that.
No, that's not Jung's view at all. Who said that?
It's something that you hear. You know, like a friend of mine remarked after he'd done his therapy training that Jung was his religion. And I think that's a sentiment that a lot of people share, that the archetypal psychology is a kind of religious format or something, you know.
I think they're mistaking the wood for the trees. I don't agree with that. I think Jung is a bridge into religion, but Jung isn't a religion. I mean, he'd be the first one to say that he's not replacing religion. He's trying to help people understand religion. Mm-hmm. And constantly he tried to encourage Christians to go back to Christianity, which is a bit ironic because he didn't, you know. But I think he had this kind of hygienic view of the whole process of the clinical practice. It was hygienic. He would tell a Jew to go back to Judaism. You know, he would tell a Muslim to go back to Islam. But I think the Richard Knoll book, you know, The Jung Cult, is complete nonsense from beginning to end, as was his follow-up book, The Aryan Christ. I tell you what, if you want sparks to fly, put me on with Richard Knoll. I'll tear him to shreds. I think he's at, is he at Harvard or something like that? that if you want an Australian professor to attack an American professor, you're on.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And it happened. Well,
you know, one of the questions that was on my mind coming into this conversation was, you know, Jung had this idea that a new religion was coming, and it may take, you know, 500 or 600 years for it to form.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of what's happening? Because one of the things I appreciate about your writing and your lectures is that you really have kept your finger on the pulse of the spirit of the times, like staying in contact with young people and asking them about their spiritual life and proclivities. Yeah. And so I think you're uniquely situated to maybe suggest what might be coming.
Well, the Red Book is all about the way that is to come. You know, there's a section in the Red Book called the Way of the Future, or the Way that is to come. Now, that comment he made about 500 or 600 years, that was to that Los Angeles Jungian analyst, forgotten his name now, originally from Berlin. Jung says that the new church is being built already.
Mm-hmm.
It says it's going to take 600 years. They're building it in China. They're building it in Russia. They're building it in North America. Interestingly enough, he never mentions poor old Australia in any of his...
Or Canada either. Jeez.
No, exactly. Canada and Australia.
We don't have much of a personality anyway. We usually just follow along with whatever the Americans are doing.
Exactly. Canada and Australia are in a similar boat.
So keep us out of it, you know? We'll... And we don't want to be in the vanguard of anything.
Jung says that the temple of the future is being built already. I think he's right. I think there is a new religion coming. I don't think that I can yet understand what it is, but it's got to be draw hugely on Buddhism.
I think it has to be eclectic.
Yeah.
At this stage, in postmodernism, it has to be eclectic, and it has to allow people to connect to different forms of God.
And that's why the American Jungian Christians give me the shivers, you know, because they're on the wrong track.
Mm-hmm.
Jung did say over and over again that Buddhism is one of the world's greatest religions. He did say Buddhism had depth psychology before it was even invented in the West. You know,
the thing that irks me, you know, as someone who studied yoga, around the same time as the Buddha, there was Patanjali in India,
yes,
who wrote the Yoga Sutra, and Jung, I don't think, has ever commented on the Yoga Sutra. Like, he's commented on Kundalini Yoga, like the Tantric Yoga, because that was probably more kind of exciting to him. But if you read the Yoga Sutra, I mean, it is an incredible psychology.
Incredible psychology before psychology was invented. Mm-hmm. I think this is a bit of synchronicity. A car has just pulled into my driveway with huge letters along the side saying alchemy.
There's Young's pulling up in the driveway.
Young's pulled up and we have a business here called Alchemy. He's leaving a parcel at my door. So I need to get the alchemical message. That's what synchronicity is telling me at the moment. But when I was a university student, I'm 70 now, so you know it's a long while ago, 50 years ago. Most of my colleagues, peers, had abandoned Christianity to enter Buddhism. So you've got to realize that Australia is actually in Asia. It's not like America, which is stuck right over the other side of the Pacific. We are hugely influenced by Asia. I looked up the other day, how many Chinese are there in the city of Melbourne where I live? 500,000 Chinese live in my city alone, let alone Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide, etc. We are hugely influenced by Asia in more ways than one. And I think that Jung cautioning, saying Westerners should remain Western, they should read the East but not become followers of Buddhism and Hinduism and so on, Taoism in particular, which is very strong with the Chinese here in my city, that is very dated, as you intimated before. That's Jung speaking as a pre-postmodernist. You know, you can't say that anymore. Australia, which is largely a European culture, living at the foot of Asia, is going to be hugely influenced by Asian religions, especially Buddhism. There's a little bit of Hinduism here, but of course Hinduism isn't as attractive as Buddhism. And Taoism is probably more attractive than any.
Hinduism's too messy.
Hinduism is still hundreds of gods.
Yeah. Well, see? Something just popped up actually as you're talking. Alchemy. What can we learn from these different world religions without co-opting them? Well, Hinduism can teach us about polytheism.
Yeah.
Buddhism can teach us about internal practices, perhaps. Islam can teach us maybe about regular daily ritual, like incorporating your religious practice into your everyday life, you know? I don't know. That's kind of an interesting idea that it's never come to me before, that we can learn about the new form not by co-opting the forms of other religions, but the kind of principles or essence of them, maybe.
Exactly. One of the things being said at the moment in my country, because a lot of young people don't follow Christianity anymore, a lot of them don't follow Judaism anymore, the Jewish ones, they're being very attracted to indigenous religions, and they're very attracted to the Aboriginal rituals and ceremonies. And some of them want to get initiated into these indigenous religions. But the Aboriginal people who are vocal about this on television and radio, newspapers, are saying, look, we want appreciation, but we don't want appropriation. Mm-hmm. So that's the two key words in my country at the moment. We do want the white fellas, as they call people like me. I'm a so-called white fella, although I don't look very white, but I look pink to my eyes. But we don't want you appropriating our religion, but we do want you appreciating it. And I think there's a very strong distinction between that. So there's a huge interest in indigenous religions in my country at the moment. And you can understand why, because at the time of a ecological environmental crisis, environmental catastrophe, the indigenous religions of the world are the ones with the answers.
That's what I was thinking, you know, in terms of what can we learn from the other world religions, from, you know, the indigenous religions of the Americas and probably equally so Australian Aborigines, that reverence for nature, nature yeah. as mother and father, and also yeah. initiation.
Yes, absolutely. The young people of Australia are walking around saying, why aren't I getting initiated? Who's going to initiate me? Well, that's where Robert Bly comes in, you know, because Robert Bly says, join the men's movement to get initiated that way. You know, hug a tree, howl at the moon like a wolf.
Oh, come on. He said a lot better things than that.
I'm just parodying him. But hug a big pine tree and feel yourself part of it. But, you know, I think initiation and reverence for nature are the two big contributions that all Indigenous religions make. When I was in Canada with Hillman in Montreal, I met some Canadian Indian people, and they were the two things they spoke about was initiation and nature.
Mm.
That's huge for them. And then I said to them, it's the same in Australia. Initiation and nature are the two big things. And you know, those are the things that we need. There's an old saying in Africa, if you don't initiate the boys, they burn down the village.
Burn down the village just to feel its warmth.
Just to feel their own power, their ability to burn down something. There's so much antisocial feeling in young men worldwide at the moment because mm-hmm. society is not feeding their spirit.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, that's the way I've heard the proverb from Michael Mead is they burn it down just to feel its warmth. And what that speaks to me is that they haven't felt the value from yes. the community because they haven't
Absolutely.
Been. Yeah.
I've been in Africa again this year. I'm often in Africa. I learn a lot about myself and African culture when I'm in Africa. But initiation is still hugely important in, you know, most tribal African cultures, less so in the urbanized Africans, but you know, Jung too learned a lot from Africa. He went on that expedition to Uganda and Kenya and learned a lot from that. Jungians today tend to very critical of Jung, saying he had white superiority complex and he wasn't very kind to the Africans. But you can't expect Jung to be everything. You know? We've got to be post-Jungian. You know? We've got to understand this old saying that he's man of his time. Of course he had a white superiority complex. Every white did in his day. Why should he be any different? And so we shouldn't feign or put on this kind of this disgust in Jung because he had a white superiority complex. I think that's going too far. He learned a lot from Africa, and he learned that initiation is very important, and he learned that nature is very important.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like when he talks about that encounter with Mountain Lake and with yes. some of the African people that he met and yeah. their sun rituals and how central yeah. that was and how they got it. They got that relationship between the living yeah. symbol of the sun and the living God.
He went there with a couple of mates, H.G. Baines from London and some guy from America, and he headed straight for Mount Elgonyi, which is, I think, in Uganda, but it's also such a big mountain. I think you'd think so in Kenya. And he learned a lot from those people. And I think that's an important thing that you know, he went, of course, to New Mexico, learnt a lot from the Pueblo Indians in New Mexico. Did he go to Canada? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
No, and he didn't go to Australia either, see, because we don't count, you see. But, my God, if he'd come here, there would have been so much here that would have interested in him.
Mm-hmm.
He did read Australian anthropology, he read the Native Tribes of Central Australia by Baldwin Spencer and Frank Gillan, and learned a lot from about Australian original, you know, First Nations people.
Yeah, it was same with Canadian Indigenous. He only commented, as far as I know, on some early, like, Victorian anthropology of the Inuit people.
Yes.
And he talked a lot about their kind of everyday dream work that they would do, and the idea of a concept of the soul and things like that. Yes. He had a lot of respect for Indigenous
when I was in Africa at this time. I met a lot of Islamic people. In my ignorance, I hadn't realized how huge Islam is, not just in northern Africa, but also in central, eastern, and western Africa as well. I was in West Africa this year, in a country called Ghana, and it's hugely Islamic, you know. And one of the things I was impressed by was the daily rituals that you mentioned, the daily prayer rituals, you know, and people would have watches on their wrist that would buzz at a certain time, which meant that it was time to prayer, time to go to pray to God, to Allah. And I thought, wow, you know, I really respect that.
Imagine if the whole world was doing that, you know?
Yeah. So long as you really are praying and not just massaging your ego, you know, like, I'd look at the sum of people praying. You know. Something I found a bit critical of in Africa is that a lot of people, I asked them why they were so religious when I come from a country which is essentially anti-religious. They say, well, because if we pray hard to God, we will be rewarded by gifts.
Yeah.
See, I'm not too keen on that. I don't know how valuable that prayer is. Frankly, I said that to a couple of them. They were very annoyed with me. I said, I pray at times, you know, I pray every night before I go to sleep, and because that's what I was taught to do. And I ask God what I can do for God. No, I don't ask God what God can do for me. Some of the people I spoke to thought that was pretty odd. So, you know, there are so many different kinds of prayer and so many different kinds of religion. I feel that if you're praying to God because you want a new bicycle for Christmas, that's not prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That's Freudian. That's wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
Right.
What do you think is the benefit of prayer from a psychological perspective? Because one of the things that, you know, in the counseling work that I do is, if the person seems like they might be receptive to it, I always recommend prayer.
Mm. Well, I on this question, I'm purely Jungian again. That is, prayer builds the ego self axis.
Right. That egoic relationship to something greater than the ego. Yeah.
I don't care who you pray to, whether it's Allah, Buddha, whoever it is. It doesn't even matter to me.
The sun or the moon or the earth.
Yeah, I don't care. Whether it's the tree in your back garden, it's still prayer. It's still valuable. It's got to be something bigger than you. That's where I'm a postmodern relativist. You know, the Catholics hate me saying stuff like that.
But I agree. I mean, if there is going to be a new universal religion, I think the important thing is that principle of devotion to something greater than yourself, something like the greater whole, however you conceptualize that, whatever represents that to you, as long as the image that represents that opens your heart.
Yes, exactly. And that's what's important. The people in Africa I spoke to were trying to assure me that Allah is the same as the Christian God. Funny how they feel a bit defensive about Islam when they talk to a Christian like me, or a so-called Christian. Actually, I'm a post-Christian, of course, just as I'm post-modern and also post-Jungian. I'm post-everything. you know, even post the posts. So it's very important for us to keep in touch with the spirit of the time, as you mentioned earlier. I think, you know, and that's why Jung's work has to be updated. It can't be just parroted off by, you know, card-carrying Jungians. It's not good.
Mm.
It's got to be alive. It's got to be. It's got to put the two big things at the top, which is the environment and race relations.
Mm.
You know, they're the two big political issues of our time: race relations and nature. And you know, Jung was good on nature, but he wasn't terrific on race relations.
He couldn't do it all, right?
He can't do it all. Why should we expect him to?
Yeah. I love that. And one of the things that I think is really important, and maybe it comes from, you know, me being like a lay person or lay scholar of all this stuff. But I think the democratization of depth psychology and Jung's ideas is really, really important.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, bringing it to the people, like out of the analysis room and into the community. So one of the things that I've been doing is doing these inner journeying workshops, where basically we go on a inner shamanic type journey, and then we talk about it in, you know, using a lot of those principles from Hillman and Jung. Everybody pays 10 or 20 bucks. That's what I mean by democratization.
Rather than 10 or 20,000 bucks.
Yeah, exactly. Twice a week at 200 bucks a pop.
At one stage, I toyed with the idea of retraining as an analyst. And I talked to a local analyst who lives near me. And he said, basically, you've got to have enough money to buy a second house. You know, well, that's not the democratization of Jung, is it?
Well, and then all your clients are only going to be wealthy people too.
Yeah, with two houses as well.
Yeah.
All the people in Jungian analysis in Australia own a city house and a beach house.
Hmm.
Well, good for them.
That's what we call up here white people problems.
first world problems. You know, how many black people are in analysis? Well, they can't afford it.
Yeah.
This American term, people of color, we don't use that here, but I quite enjoy that American term, people of color. No people of color. When Robert Johnson was here giving lectures, there was one African guy in the room, come from America, from the US, he came from New York, and Robert Johnson came up to him at the end. This is poor Robert showing his ignorance, and he said to this guy, "I'm so pleased to have an Australian Aborigine in the room." And we all just burst laughing, including this guy himself. He said, "No, I'm from New York." I said, "Robert, I'm sorry, you haven't got any Aboriginal people in the room." You just got a face.
Well, great illustration of how much of a bubble a lot of Jungians live in.
Yeah, he thought that a person of color in Australia must be Aboriginal. It's not true. There are pretty much more Africans in Australia than there are Aboriginals in Australia.
Mm.
Because the British massacred most of them, you know, massacred thousands, hundreds of thousands of indigenous people got massacred by the British from 1788 onwards. It's atrocious. And that's why facing these racial issues is so hard, because the guilt associated all these massacres is enormous. Often too big for churches and schools and all of our institutions to deal with. But I agree with you about the democratization very much. Charge 20 bucks, you know, instead of 350 bucks for a seminar. So people, normal people, come along.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very strongly about this. I'm tired of writing books that only the upper middle class can afford to buy. I think you've found that on the internet, my books are too expensive.
Expensive, and that's such a shame, because I think your books actually are quite accessible to the layperson, you know? Well, you have a very down-to-earth way of writing.
Yeah, I try to, because I had a blue-collar upbringing as well, like you. I'm from the working classes. My parents were contract cleaners, and they didn't finish high school, let alone university. So I have inbuilt in me enormous respect for ordinary workers, and I don't want to feel that I'm betraying them by writing books that cost $85 US on the internet.
And you know what I found too, and this is one of the joys of me kind of tapping into that market by virtue of, you know, who I am. But the average Joe has the most extraordinary dreams.
Oh, yes. That's right. Know,
surprisingly, grand dreams for people living ordinary lives. Yeah.
Tradespeople, you know, and people doing these types of jobs often come to work thinking about last night's dream, you know. How are they going to get help by Jungian thinking? Well, they can't. Priced out of their range. And so I think Jung had the right idea toward the end of his life, you know, when he wrote Man and His Symbols, you know, which people disregard that as being sort of irrelevant. But it was important for him to write a book like that, which was fairly simple, priced sensibly, and had a wide readership. Whereas who's going to read a book called Mysterium Conjunctionis?
That's the one that came to mind, actually, as like the exact opposite of Man and His Symbols.
Well, the funny thing is he wrote them together, you know.
Well, I mean, didn't Marie-Louise von Franz really put Man and His Symbols together for him?
She did.
I mean, she was such a practical kind of lady and practical writer, it seems like, very direct. And
yeah, thank God for Marie-Louise von Franz, because Jung was purely stuck in his mythic mind, writing Mysterium Conjunctionis. But the modern mind, you know, and the social mind that might have had a sense of compassion for ordinary people was writing Man and His Symbols at the same time. And then, of course, I think it was Aniela Jaffe, who encouraged him to compose his memoirs, you know, which became Memories, Dreams, Reflections. But without Aniela Jaffe, I don't think he would have written that book at all.
You know? Yeah, well, I think she really compiled that from his notes.
Yeah, well, Sonu Shamdasani says she wrote it. Hmm. And I'm sure that that could be true, that she based a lot of her work on Jung's own recollection. I think those early chapters about his childhood and God shitting on the church, I think that was written in his own hand. But I think a lot of the rest of it was written in consultation with Jung by Aniela Jaffe. So when we refer to that book in essays and books, I think we should refer to her as at least a co-author, if not the author of that book. And I think we should stop calling it an autobiography and call it memoirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a theme running throughout our whole discussion, is the kind of forgotten women of these movements. So the women who were really pivotal to Jung's work and getting it to a wider audience, and also the development of Hillman psychology. I mean, nobody talks about Patricia Berry, but apparently she was a huge influence on the development of archetypal psychology.
Huge influence. I mean, Hillman recognized what a huge influence she was. He also says Rafael Lopez Pedraza was a huge influence too, the guy that wrote the book called Hermes and His Children. But Jung didn't acknowledge women enough. And again, this is where he was a very patriarchal guy, you know. This idea of anima and animus wasn't his original thought. It was Sabina Spielrein's thought. Mm. And he thought, what a great idea. I'm going to run with that. The typology, a lot of the typology work came from Tony Wolfe. Mm. You know, it wasn't him. He developed it, but the seed ideas came from women. His own wife, Emma York, spent a huge number of years working on the Grail myth, which she didn't finish. But thanks to Marie-Louise von Franz, she came in at the end and finished it off for her. Otherwise, that book would have never been published. But I think that Jung field, you know, everyone mentions Jung and Erich Neumann, but no one talks about the importance of Sabina Spielrein or Agnella Yaffe or Marie-Louise von Franz or Barbara Hannah and Esther Harding, all these women. This is my feminist side coming out again. I get really worked up about these things. And everyone puts him on the pedestal and they don't recognize how he was indebted to the women around him who hugely influenced him, especially Tony Wolfe. I think it was Tony Wolfe that came up with the whole idea of types. And then, of course, he ran with it and published Psychological Types in 1921.
Yeah. Well, David, I really appreciate this chat. It's just, it's felt like a gossip session between a young man and an older man, you know, like I'm just kind of, give me some more morsels. I've just really enjoyed hanging out with you. It's been very informal, but I like that.
A chat between a young man and a young old man. No, when you said young, it sounded like Jung to me.
Jung, yeah, right. I get it.
Anyway, sorry for going on too long. It's already passed by lunchtime.
Yeah, no, I've just, like I said, it's been a lot of fun hanging out with you. And thanks for your time.
Like Hillman, I like fighting. So if you want to put me up against somebody, I'm all for it, you know. I'd be in the blue corner, they'll be in the red corner. What I would love to do would be to debate Jordan Peterson, but I'm never going to get near him because he's too famous.
Yeah, I'm Canadian. I can't even get his phone number.
Yeah, I can't either.
He came. He's moved to the States now, so he's gone full red pill. He's gone full right wing. You know, he's living in like Alabama or something now.
Oh, he came to Australia, and I was hoping the media would put us together, but it didn't. So he's too huge for that. Yeah. But I would be wanting to talk to him and show him how absolutely wrong his ideas are.
Well,
he'd write me off as a feminist. I know that.
Yeah. What could be interesting, because I don't even think you need a foil in front of you to let it rip, but I would actually really enjoy hearing from you like a critique of Jordan Peterson, because I have my own critiques, but it doesn't mean as much coming from me. But I'd like to hear from you what you think about his biblical exegesis and all of that sometime. Yeah.
I don't know, probably don't know as much about it as you do. You see, I get so wild and angry looking at his stuff, I ended up throwing it at the wall, you know. And I have his current book called The Seven Rules for Living or something. It makes me so angry. That's the problem. You see, I can debate about Hillman because Hillman never made me angry. I can't debate sensibly about Jordan Peterson because the anger rises. And when my anger gets high, my rational thinking is lowered and I start swearing.
You just start ranting, yeah.
Ranting and becoming too angry. And a lot of people have asked me to give public lectures on Jordan Peterson, but I've refused so far because, frankly, there's so much else I want to talk about publicly in Jordan fucking Peterson.
Okay, I hear you too, man. He gets enough airtime. But what I'm really interested in is kind of continuing a discussion about where all this is headed, you know, what religion can learn from psychology, what psychology can learn from religion, and what they can both learn from the spiritual but not religious movement, which I think is really interesting and you've touched on in lectures. So, I just really appreciate... sorry, you can hear the dogs are all over me right now, so I know my time is up. But I really appreciate your kind of unguardedness and your openness just to have a chat. You know, that's rare, and I think maybe because you don't have a reputation as an analyst to uphold or any affiliations, you're just free to speak your mind, which is great.
Yeah,
because you've done the work. You know,
I can let it rip.
Yeah, let it rip.
My patients won't get pissed off because I don't have any.
That's right. It's great. And you've retired from teaching, so you don't have to worry about pissing them off.
I don't have to worry about pissing anyone off, except my publisher. Okay. Thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about so many things.
Yeah, it's been epic. I'll have to go through and edit it, maybe get it down to a more condensed version or something. We'll see how it goes.
Whatever. Feel free to do whatever editing you like. Yeah.
Cheers. Well, go enjoy the rest of your day if you can. Maybe the sun will come out and warm you up a bit.
Yeah, the sun's behind cloud at the moment because it's winter here. All right. Cheers, Brian. Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
The Medicine Path is produced by Brian James on unceded Coast Salish territory, Vancouver Island, Canada. For more information, visit brianjames.ca. Music by Olive Artizzoni, a.k.a. Greenhouse. Join the Medicine Path tribe and gain early access to episodes and the full podcast archives at patreon.com/medicinepath. May the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. May the rain fall soft upon your fields. Until the next time we meet on the Medicine Path.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.